Hello and welcome back to The Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. This week, the fallout from the controversial Sewell report on racial disparity in the UK. A bad faith attempt to reduce real issues of racism to a culture war talking point, brave thinking outside the box, or something more complex. Special guest Matthew Ryder QC, formerly London's Deputy Mayor for Social Integration, Social Mobility and Community Engagement, joins us to look at the report and its aftermath. Plus, on a more cheerful note, is Britain actually less divided than we thought? New research suggests that the pandemic has both united and divided us in different ways. And the English Heritage Blue Plaque Scheme. Princess Diana is getting one, supposedly to address gender imbalance. Who gets them? Who should get them? And should there be more of them outside London? All that and more on today's Bunker. Welcome back to the weekly panel edition of The Bunker. We've got three of our regulars here, and ordinarily we'd engage in leisurely chit-chat first, but there's loads to get through, so let's just say hello to Times Radio host and recovering New Labour spin doctor Ayesha Hazarika.
Hello.
We've also got editor of the LSE's COVID-19 blog, Roz Taylor.
Hello.
And comedian and broadcaster Ahir Shah.
Hi.
And as I mentioned, we're delighted to be joined by Matthew Ryder QC, Matrix Chambers Barrister and former Deputy Mayor of London for Social Integration, Social Mobility and Community Engagement. Sorry, that's a mouthful. Hello, Matthew. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine.
Welcome to The Bunker. Thanks for joining us. Let's get straight into that Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities report, as it's called. It was written by an independent panel, supposedly, asterisk, including the head of an educational charity, a space scientist and a businessman. And its findings claim to present a new race agenda for the country and prove that the claim that the country is still institutionally racist is not borne out by the evidence. The response was angry. Johnson's special advisor for civil society and communities, Samuel Kasamu, resigned last week, citing unbearable tensions in Number 10. Leading academics, including people from the King's Fund and the LSE, say that they were inaccurately cited in the report. It's been attacked as similar to the 1776 Commission, where the Trump presidency in its dying days attempted to create a reactionary new history of America. Ayesha, this report has come in for huge criticism. Broadcaster David Olusoga said that it was sweeping history under the carpet, and Doreen Lawrence even accused it of glorifying the slave trade. What did you think of it?
It was like a sort of punch to the gut. I find the whole thing incredibly upsetting. I don't like to think of myself as a snowflake at all, but I did find it incredibly upsetting. I mean, I wrote a piece for the I newspaper, and my own history with this is that I was a very young civil servant press officer working at the Home Office when the McPherson report came out into how the Metropolitan Police had handled the murder investigation of Stephen Lawrence. And that report was seminal, and I was working very closely with the Lawrence family and with Paul Boateng and Jack Straw at the time. And for me, there was such a huge moment when that phrase institutional racism was coined in that report. And it explained so much, particularly to a person of colour like myself. It just explained everything. And I thought it was a really brave thing for, the great and the good to admit that there was this thing called institutional racism, because you knew it existed, but no one ever dared give it a name. So, 20 odd years later, to see this report just sort of rip up this concept of institutional racism. I kind of actually wrote in the piece that Lord McPherson died this year, and I think in some ways it's probably a mercy that he didn't see his very thoughtful, seminal piece of work just tossed in the bin and replaced with the intellectual equivalent of a fart in a lift, which everybody wanted to distance themselves from as soon as it came out. It was just, there was a lot of stuff in there that was quite interesting, but it wasn't anything new. What was new were two big standout things. One, kind of somehow suggesting that slavery was an enhancing experience, like some sort of all-inclusive sort of cruise or something. And secondly, this denial of institutional racism. It's interesting that the commission then came out saying, oh, everyone's attacking us, it's all been terrible. We were just not told to look for institutional racism. I mean, the whole thing was just intellectually sort of bankrupt. I just felt it was such a shame, and it caused so much hurt to people. It was a very, very dark moment, to be honest.
I mean, one of the things that the report seems to try to do is to point to ethnic minority achievements in education and some workplaces as kind of like the all-encompassing evidence that institutional racism is kind of dealt with somehow. Isn't, I mean, this seems to be quite a limited way, a limited lens of looking at it.
But also the report contradicts itself because it kind of says really proudly that, ethnic minority children are doing better than the many white working class children. And of course, there's this continuation of this very pernicious thing, which working class is only white. There's no admission that actually working class children include children from different backgrounds. So it says, hey, you know, lots of ethnic minority children do better at school, but its own statistics then show that actually a lot of those children don't get on that well in the labour market, which is because of institutional racism, which it kind of claims doesn't exist. So the whole thing, I felt, was very intellectually incoherent.
Matthew, one of your reactions to this was to quote your own brother, who's a media professor, saying journalists should report the race report in the same way they would report climate change denial, findings driven by ideology, not evidence, and contradicted by all mainstream experts and years of data. I mean, that's pretty damning. What, give us your overall take on the report.
I would agree with my brother. He's a professor of media studies and a 20-year veteran of the BBC. He was a TV executive at the BBC for a long time producing news. I think it is accurate to say that mainstream journalism should report this like climate change denial. And the reason is because it flies in the face of evidence. You've seen this flood of people who are experts saying this is just out of context, misunderstanding the evidence, misunderstanding findings, misunderstanding our own evidence to the commission itself. And it's also simply a report that aligns with a narrative that has been said from the right for a very long time, that really discussions on racism are overblown, that Britain is a wonderful society, and that the problem with people who aren't succeeding from ethnic minorities is that it's largely to do with their own dysfunctionality, or that it's not really an issue of racism at all. And the report is full of really familiar tropes that often come out from the right about trying to downplay issues of racism. So there's lots of talk about white working class people being worse off, and I'll come to that in more detail in a minute. There's lots of talk about how difficult it is to prove that there's racism, and therefore we shouldn't presume it's there. There's lots of talk about how some ethnic groups do better than others, and therefore you can't say there's racism, because if South Asian people are doing well and Black Caribbean are doing badly, how could there be racism? There's lots of talk about families being the problem, and that you need to remedy some kind of dysfunction, especially in Black families, where really it's probably the family that's causing Black children to have so many problems. There's a kind of suggestion that it's all in people's mind. This is all about perception and not reality. And then finally, as Aisha has highlighted, some really astonishing comments as a sort of final rhetorical flourish about how we should tell a more positive story about slavery and Black Caribbean people in slavery, in a way that it would just be astonishing if anybody said you should tell a more positive story about the Jewish Holocaust to Jewish people. I mean, we just wouldn't accept that, rightly so. And similarly, to tell people like myself, who are descendants of Caribbean slaves, you should view slavery more positively, even coming from someone like Tony Saw, who's in the same position, is really, really difficult to read and really unpleasant to read. So I think this is something that aligns with a narrative we've had for a very long time. So it wasn't a shock, but it's still not an easy read.
If you were a person who was trying to defend this report, you would say that it's not attempting to defend slavery per se, but it's attempting to sort of place a different framework around what culturally African people and Caribbean people have done after slavery, and how they've made themselves a stronger position and a powerful identity within Britain, you know, in a post-slavery thing. What would your reaction be to that defence?
The toll on a culture and a people of slavery is still being felt today. And so to tell the descendants of slaves, you know, you need to be more positive about the story you can tell. Yeah, obviously, there are positives that come out of immense genocide, hardship, you know, horrendous historic massacres. Of course, there are positive stories that can come out of them. But I think the way that particular point is made in the report, and it's a small point at the end of the report, but the way that point is made in the report is just a particularly unpleasant element of what is, in a much broader way, inaccurate, misleading, and kind of ideological rather than data-driven findings. I mean, I'll give you one that Aisha touched on, which is, I think, is quite important, which is that when I took over at City Hall, the position I had as Deputy Mayor for Social Integration, we did look quite a bit at this very familiar statistic of some ethnic minority groups doing better in educational outcomes than white working class boys. Trying to examine what that said, and it's a favorite statistic of the right, because in a sense it's trying to say, look, the real people who are disadvantaged are white working class boys, not black boys or boys from other ethnic minority groups. When you unpack that statistic, there are two striking things. The first is that the difference between working class boys and educational attainment is small. So we're not talking about huge gaps between the different groups. It's all very, very similar. And it's true that there are some years white working class boys come out the lowest, but it's not by a huge amount. And what that tells you is that for those at the lowest income level, their real problem is being poor. And their real problem is that they come from low income families. And so race is less of a factor if you are really suffering the impact of poverty. But the second important point that came out of that is that despite white working class boys often having the lowest educational outcomes, they consistently have better outcomes in employment and in social mobility than boys from ethnic minorities. And what that tells you is that white working class boys with lower qualifications and lower educational outcomes can achieve more in British society than black boys, for example, with higher educational qualifications and higher educational outcomes. Now, that speaks to institutional racism being a persistent factor in people's lives, not being something that is reduced in the system. And so every single time any of us hear that familiar statistic that white working class boys have lower educational outcomes, we should always accompany with that the other statistic about how those same boys have better employment outcomes and why that's a problem.
I want to come back to who's on the panel and why it was commissioned and was its stated purpose, its true purpose in a minute. But I wanted to ask you one particular thing. There's a call in the report to scrap training on unconscious bias, which produced a great deal of debate. The commission actually did conclude that unconscious bias does matter, but that businesses tend to like tick a box by sending everybody on the unconscious bias training. And then we've done that. Now it's done. Would the end of the kind of send people on a course thing be quite a good idea, that, you know, that businesses and individuals start to address the thing rather than saying, well, the, you know, somebody's been on training, therefore it's dealt with?
Yeah, well, firstly, and I can't believe I'm the first to say this, but happy new tax year. God, guys, come on. We need to be able to keep this fun as well. Obviously, unconscious bias is a thing that exists in the world. I don't know the empirical extent to which any of this training actually makes a difference. And I think it's, as you say, that it could just end up in a situation where, you know, the head of some corporation would be like, but everyone on our board, all of whom are white, have had all of this unconscious bias training. And so how could this possibly be a problem? All of the members of staff, all of whom are white, and particularly in the senior positions, have had unconscious bias training. So how could it be a problem? And yeah, it might just end up being used as a sort of fig leaf, or is that the right phrase for it, to cover up actually like a more pernicious thing that is going on, because it could just end up being, you know, inverted commas, well, I couldn't possibly be.
Friend of the podcast, Satnam Sangera, said that the report actually does have some sensible recommendations, like that they should be much more effective to tackling online abuse and online racism. And additionally, that, you know, we should scrap the BAME label, this idea that everybody who's not white is somehow the same because they go under the BAME kind of, you know, under the umbrella of that. Do you think these sensible ideas might be kind of overshadowed by the fact that, you know, that there have been such terrible clangers in this report, and that the motivation of the report is deeply questionable?
I won't be particularly sad to see the back of BAME, if only because it's always good fun that every few years white people come up with a new thing to call us.
We work hard on this.
And we work really hard on it. Look, you've been focus grouping that stuff really well. And so I don't know. I'm mainly looking forward to, I wonder what the next acronym I'm going to be homogenized into is going to be.
Perhaps we can crowdsource it from non-white people would be a good idea. I don't know. Maybe we could do it through the podcast. White people have been doing a lot of hard work on this. It's about time we got a break on this one, I hear.
Yes, Patreon subscribers are allowed to do a poll.
Yes, for £2 a month, you can end racism. Yeah. Roz, I mean, world of academia, I mentioned academics have accused the report of misquoting them, cherry-picking their stuff, saying that they provided new access in new research when they didn't. Does this report have much credibility from an academic point of view? And does it even matter if it doesn't? Because it clearly has, as we're going to discuss, the motivations are not entirely purely academic.
No, I mean, I read a lot of academic reports in my job, and I can tell you that this is a deeply flawed report that is weirdly incoherent at times. I mean, there's some downright bizarre assertions that BLM protesters, for example, last year were amplifying intergenerational strife, which is bizarre. And then it says the idea that all ethnic minority people suffer a common fate and share disadvantage is an anachronism. Well, I mean, that's just a straw man argument. It's revealing the report's real intention, which is to launch itself into the culture wars, really. And then there are other very strange things where it wades into territory it really doesn't need to get into. I mean, it says, for example, that as Matthew points out, a large number of single mothers who are also black is caused partly by the welfare state enabling them to be single mothers. Setting aside the fact that the whole direction of public policy in the last 10 years has been to make it more and more difficult for people to be single mothers and to afford to do so, it is extraordinarily crass. And it sets up the thesis of the whole report, which is that the problem is not racism. And therefore, if the problem is not racism, then it's either got to be structural inequality that causes it, or it's people's own fault. And of course, ultimately, the report therefore tends to the view that it is structural inequalities and structural problems. But then, as Aisha has pointed out, it doesn't like talking about structural problems again. So it's floundering around all over the place, trying to set up and prove its core argument.
Could I just add something that I think is quite important, which is Aisha talked about the McPherson, the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry report, and the recommendations about institutional racism. That report was 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, and it was a seminal moment, not just in British public policy, but in British society and British culture. You know, I represented the family of Stephen Lawrence. It was a moment in which UK society took a world-leading position in trying to understand modern racism, how it affected people, and how it affected structures and organisations in a way that impacted on people's lives. It was a very, very powerful moment, and it has underpinned the thinking of public policy and how we approach race for 20 years. This report is taking a huge step backwards and harking to an era prior to the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry report, in which we didn't have a sophisticated understanding of racism and how it affected society. This is a huge backwards moment, and it is, if this report starts to influence public policy, it is undoing what British society should rightly have been proud of in understanding racism in its modern forms. This is a retrograde perspective, a backwards-looking perspective, and it's not where we thought we were as a society.
I completely just echo everything that Matthew has said. And I think for so many people, there was this kind of sickening feeling that all the progress that was made was like just, you know, the stroke of a pen. And I could just see, I mean, you know, it was like a day at the racists on my timeline. It was a green light for all those people to come out and say, yeah, stop playing the race card. Like, we're sick of it. It's all on you. It's down to you. Like, we're sick of all this sort of, you know, blaming the state for everything, blaming institutions for everything. I mean, Doreen Lawrence came out and I think rightly said that this is going to be a green light for bigots now. And I just, you know, as Matthew just said, I mean, I think for so many people that have been campaigning in this area, working in this area, it's kind of just bewildering that this has been done. And I think so many people just feel exhausted, really quite sort of beaten down by this, quite ground down by it. I mean, wiser heads have spoken to me since I did an interview with Lord Simon Woolley, who's done a lot of work on a cross-party basis with Operation Black Boat. I spoke with Diane Abbott over the weekend, and they were saying, look, no, you've got to still be hopeful, because actually the backlash to this report has galvanised a lot of people. But I actually feel quite, I don't use this word lightly, I feel quite frightened that we have a situation where people thought it was okay to just turn the clock back like this. And I really worry that the culture wars that, you know, America rejected by getting rid of Donald Trump, you know, we have people in number 10 Downing Street who are basically trying to recreate that here on these shores. And it's so depressing.
But it's mainstreaming a fringe view. And the danger of that is, if you take, for example, Cressida Dick of the Metropolitan Police, who has for the last few years been saying consistently she doesn't believe there is institutional racism in the Metropolitan Police. And when she was saying that, for many people, that felt like somebody who was simply not getting to grips with problems within her own organisation. This report is mainstreaming a view that institutional racism really isn't something you need to worry about. And it is putting us back into a position where racism is only something that's about bad-minded people who have a kind of unpleasant view towards minorities. And it's not, and racism is no longer something which we've come to understand it to be, which is not about bad intention, but can be well-meaning and can be something that is manifest through the structural inequalities in an organization. Even if people aren't meaning to do harm to others, the outcomes can be harmful to ethnic minorities. And that is what institutional racism is about. And this is deliberately making it okay to say institutional racism is not a problem.
Well, Aisha, what you were just saying then, I'm going to paraphrase a friend who's black and who works at a major organization which has had its own serious problems with institutional racism in the past. What he said to me broadly was, the problem is it doesn't matter now if the report falls apart in public because it's done its job. Everybody who wants to say, well, I work hard too, it's not racism holding you back, all the white people who say that, they're loving it. And what my friend said was, 40 fucking years of fighting for progress has been delegitimized in one day. Everybody I know is absolutely exhausted. Exactly what you said, Aisha. We've been fighting so hard for meaningful change, but this means that all the progress is going to be rolled back. We're just going to hear about useless, unconscious bias training and poor white working class boys blaming us for our failures. It just, I mean, that's, it's almost exactly what you just said, Aisha.
Yeah, and I think it just feels like, again, this word exhausted is just how so many people feel. And I got messages on my timeline. I did this big discussion on Saturday morning on Times Radio, and I got messages coming through going, well, there can't be racism because you're on the radio now. So if there's racism, how come you're on the radio? I mean, it's just this reductive argument.
Every non-white person in the country is on the radio. I've noticed this. In fact, it's amazing that Roz and I are on broadcast at all, really.
I know. I think because basically there's a quota system. We get a grant for having you on the bunker. It's like...
My mum's on Six Music right now.
Great set, I hear, yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, though, I mean, we know that, like, the driving force behind this is Munira Mirza in the number 10 policy unit, an alumnus of Spiked, who has said frequently in the past, you know, attempted to undermine the notion of institutional racism. Is it going to achieve its goal? Because, I mean, we can see the headlines this week, you know, Robert Toombs in The Spectator, the race report critics are guilty of gaslighting, attacking the critics of the race report. Telegraph, meet Tony Sewell, the man who took on the race clique. Is it going to achieve its goal?
I think one thing that I find sort of particularly disheartening, and have obviously found very disheartening over really the course of the last decade, is that none of this is that surprising, given we are governed by a group of people whose guiding philosophy seems to be things can't get better, and a really good way of convincing people that things can't get better, or another side of that, is saying to them, well, this actually isn't that bad, or this current situation's basically fine, and then we can continue as the Conservative Party going merrily along our way of stagnation and or managed decline, as we've seen since the beginning of the Cameron era. And yeah, it's just, it's not surprising, because it fits into that sort of entire wider thing of cudgeling us to a situation where we can't expect any sense of improvement in this country.
But the lesson here is for Labour. You know, the lesson, this should be a wake-up call for people on the left. And what I mean by that is that there is a real feeling amongst people from black and minority ethnic communities that Labour does not properly give them a platform to express their views, or the left generally, liberals generally, don't give people of colour an opportunity to express their views, to have a platform. Aisha and I and everybody else notwithstanding on this podcast.
Very kind of you to say that, Matthew.
You're welcome. Don't have a sufficient voice, you know. And if you look at the Labour Party, for example, you know, I think those within the Labour Party now would probably feel that, you know, those views expressed by this report, commissioned by, you know, the Johnson administration, don't represent us. We would speak favourably about institutional racism. We would understand these issues. Really, we're on the right side of this. But they're not. And the reason they're not is because if you look at Johnson's administration, much as you may, if you, you may really dislike their politics, but they have a person of South Asian heritage as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, a person of South Asian heritage as the Home Secretary. By the way, the second person of South Asian heritage in a row in each of those jobs. They have people of colour, whether it's James Cleverly or the business secretary, whoever you want to point to, people in big, serious jobs in that administration championing the Johnson line and being trusted with serious responsibility. Look at Labour, and what you see is people of colour, David Lammy being an exception, not being given those big jobs or that big platform and not being trusted, it seems, from the outside with the big responsibility. And that sends an awful message. And I've got to say that, you know, whether it's Brexit or the Red Wall, Labour didn't accept it was coming until it was right there. And we are in danger of this Tory administration, which in many ways is the most backward looking when it comes to issues of race or understanding society, being an administration that is in danger of having more credibility with people of colour than successive Labour administrations or Labour leadership has had for a long time. And that's the danger for the left.
One last thing that I'd like to say on it. I think that sort of particularly going happily, we're coming towards the end of a time, or hopefully we're coming towards the end of a time when this is true. But given that for the last 12 months, just as a country, regardless of who you are, where in the country you are, we've all been united with this one thing, COVID, and knowing as we do that it's just a statement of fact that if you're a member of an ethnic minority, you are disproportionately more likely to have died of this thing over the course of the last year, and then to have a report like this coming out at a time where we're all sort of hopeful for the vaccinations and the way that things could be in the future, does seem a bit of a kick in the fucking teeth.
Right, well, we need some uplifting news after that, and here's a small bit. This is slightly uplifting, unless you're trying to start a culture war. Britain might not be as divided as you think, but we do need to start listening to each other a bit more. Research conducted by the think tank More in Common found that the pandemic has brought Britons closer together in some respects, and that a lot of us are actually quite optimistic about the future. Roz, according to this research, British people are a lot less polarised than the media might like to say. When people are asked whether most people in their country are kind, for example, the UK scores more highly than most other nations. Tell us about this research and why it matters.
Well, with More in Common, in a sense, the clue is in the name. They do spend their time trying to find ways in things on which we agree and how public policy can take advantage of that. So, for example, I mean, one of the things they cite is for some people being concerned about climate change means that you really should be a vegan. You know, that's the logical corollary of it. But for most people, according to this report, it's actually about preserving the countryside, and that's how they can relate concerns about climate change to their everyday lives. And that is actually really important for policymakers because it gives them clues about how they can sell potentially difficult propositions to the public. And there are all kinds of quite exciting, innovative policies which are, on the face of it, very hard to sell to the public, like universal basic income, which, as I talked about on a podcast 2 or 3 weeks ago with Paula Surridge, is not particularly popular among the public unless you present it in a different way.
Do you think the pandemic has produced that sort of, you know, maybe slightly middle brow, but still sort of quite comforting all in it together factor that, you know, the British people like to romanticise so much?
I don't think it has now, no. Partly because one of the effects of the pandemic has been to atomise us as a society, lock us in our homes and stop us from talking to each other. And we do that even less than we did before. But the important thing to say about this is that in the future, that may change. One of the points Tim Dixon makes is that it takes time to build shared narratives about our history, and we don't yet know what our shared narrative about the pandemic is going to be. Take the Blitz, for example. The Blitz was bloody horrific, but in the popular imagination, it has come to symbolise something else. It has come to symbolise strength and endurance and resilience and all those things. If we think about the Blitz, I mean, 173 people died in the Blitz at Bethnal Green tube station because they were all rushing to the shelter and they were basically trampled to death. It was like Hillsborough. Bomb didn't actually fall on that station, but the 173 people died nonetheless. But we don't remember that. And I can imagine that under the right conditions, the pandemic will become mythologized by many as a period of tranquility when families got to spend time together and there was less pollution and people on furlough got a break from work and a chance to have a bit more free time and people on the front line were recognized for what they do. So it may well be that in the coming years, the pandemic comes to feel like a very different experience than the one it did when we were all told to stay at home.
I hear, you know, when it comes to judging the government in this survey, British people are quite reserved. The attitude is, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes, compared to the United States, where views are much more polarised and often quite hostile. Does it surprise you that after all the divisions of the Brexit years, there's actually a bit more of a kind of an equivocal?
I'm not particularly surprised by that, just because of the point in time that we're at, right? Like, I think that must have a huge amount to do with just the nature of the pandemic. And of course, you'd look at people having to make a life or death decision. And quite a natural response, I think, is, oh, no, either couldn't do that, or I wouldn't want to, or I don't envy their position, or even let's let them off the hook a bit for things that might have gone wrong, because it's people sort of trying their best. Equally, I will say that I'm currently reading Failures of State in fits and starts, because I can only make it through about a couple of dozen pages at a time before getting apoplectically furious. During portions of last year, I did myself quite often feel, well, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes and that sort of thing. Now I'm like, comparatively, even I would have done better than this. I'd have at least gone to the meetings, you know? I'd have been curious. I'm a curious person.
I mean, we've touched on this before, haven't we? The idea that recognising that the government has done a bad job, and even worse, a lazy job, is to kind of admit that you're in deeper shit than you thought you were.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
much
sure.
more comfortable to say, well, they are doing their best. Away from the government, you know, Britain's opinion of itself, Britain, and this is during the pandemic, so everybody all countries were questioned at the same time. The UK has a stronger sense of community than certain other nations. 64% of British people agreed with the statement that the pandemic has shown most people in our country care about each other, and it's only 57% in Germany, and it's only 40% in France. Does that chime with your lived experience? The idea that the sense that whatever the British think about their government, what they think about one another is perhaps a little bit more encouraging.
Yeah, and I am very encouraged by that. Like, and particularly one of the things that I've been really encouraged by is the enthusiasm for vaccine uptake, and particularly among people in my generation and stuff, for whom, you know, on average, the health effects of this thing wouldn't necessarily be as bad as it would be for people quite a bit older. But it's a sense of, well, we've got to do this for one another and do this for society. So yeah, maybe there is some truth in that. And if so, that's a very nice thing and a very fortunate thing, particularly at this kind of time, because certainly not all countries are in that position where people are going to go out for these vaccines and whatnot.
And it's not just a case of, you know, whether the country actually is divided on its opinions, but also whether it perceives itself to be divided, because your perception is everything. Only 55% of British people under this survey perceive Britain to be a divided country. It's down from February 2020, when 67% of people thought that the country was divided, which presumably was at the height of the Brexit thing and before the COVID pandemic kicked in and changed attitudes. So is anybody ever going to tell all the newspapers and, you know, Left Twitter and Julia Hartley Brewer and Right Twitter, fan of GB News, breaking news, guys, we're not actually a divided country at all, or we don't think we are?
Well, I think it depends on what people perceive to constitute a real division. For example, there were definitely times when, during the Brexit crises, multiple over the course of the last few years, where I would be talking to friends who had voted Leave and just been like, look, I really don't want to fucking hear it because this is going so badly right now. And then even we in our friendship felt divided in that sense. Whereas now, I think once again, particularly as a consequence of the pandemic, certain things that seemed like insurmountable divides and like, you know, oh, I feel divided from X because they voted for a different party or they like believe a different thing about whatever. Maybe this we're all a bit more conscious of, there's that quote of be kind because everyone is fighting an unwinnable war. And maybe we're all that little bit more conscious of the unwinnable wars that we're all fighting. And so might cut one other bit of slack more now.
I'm just thinking of our new spin-off podcast, Here's Leavey Mates. Here and His Leavey Mates. Aisha.
Can I just come back to that? I think we think we're a lot more divided than we actually are because so many of us are like on social media. Mm. And on social media, we organize, and I'm completely as guilty as anybody else, we organize ourselves into tribes. We understandably pick people that we agree with. We curate a kind of an echo chamber of people whose views we agree with because that is human nature. We all, particularly during lockdown, because we haven't had anything other to do. I mean, my screen time is like, hey, your screen time is down to 29 hours a day. You know what I mean? It's like, that is how bad it is. Yeah. And most of the time I'm scrolling through Twitter going, I cannot believe such and such has had this thought or blah, blah, blah. So we all kind of do, we all, you know, your thing about, you know, GB News and everything like that. We all kind of play into that on social media. We kind of adopt a persona, even if we're not actively trolling people or kind of, you know, going to war with people. We are absolutely kind of getting stuck in that division because it feels very much bound up in our identity, whether you're a Remainer. I mean, look at what's happening in Scottish independence. You know, that is going to be another huge flashpoint of division over the next couple of weeks and beyond. But again, and to loop back to what Matthew was saying earlier about the left, I mean, one of the, I think the big problems that the left has is that we sort of think Twitter is real life and it's not. And I think the country probably in real life doesn't think it's as divided. I mean, your evidence has kind of shown that. But there is, I think, this big disconnect between people who are very, very active and passionate on social media and reality.
I wanted to just jump in there just to give a little bit of an insight as to how I've thought about this when we dealt with social integration in London, which was often happening around the same time as the kind of height of Brexit. And one of the issues that I think it's important to distinguish is a sense of division in terms of viewpoint might be quite narrow, but a sense of division in terms of actually meaningfully interacting with each other is often quite high. And so we may feel that people, we have a lot in common with people, but we're living in completely separate social activities, social channels, different ways of interacting. Even in a city like London, where you on the surface have a lot of integration, where rich people and poor people may live in the same neighborhoods alongside each other, the opportunities for meaningful interaction can be quite limited. So you develop a feeling of division sometimes, or a feeling of not being part of a broader community or broader society, because although you may share very similar views and very similar life outlook with other people, you just don't interact with them. And I think that is a challenge that local government and central government has not really stepped up to in a meaningful way, which is to create good opportunities for people from different backgrounds or from different social situations to find ways to interact with each other. We tried to do a lot of that in London, and I think the mayor is doing a really good job of trying to create those opportunities. But it, historically, it's not something we've done well. We've kind of worked on the basis if you throw people into the same space, it's all going to be fine. And it's not that simple.
In Brazil, the populist experiment is reaching a moment of crisis. Coronavirus deaths have reached record levels. Far-right President Jair Bolsonaro has been rocked by the unprecedented resignation of the heads of his army, navy and air force all at the same time. How did COVID get so out of control in Brazil? And what is this doing to Bolsonaro's project? We spoke to our man in Salvador in the north of Brazil.
Hi, my name's Dom Phillips. I'm a British freelance journalist based in Salvador in Brazil, quite often writing in The Guardian and currently doing an American journalism fellowship. The current state of play in Brazil as regards the COVID-19 pandemic is pretty grim, to be honest. There are very, very high numbers of contagion, of deaths. People who've been infected before are being infected again. There are records all the time of the amount of deaths every day. We've had confirmed deaths of nearly 4,000 people on some days. We've had 331,433 confirmed obits right now. So it's quite grim. But at the same time, the federal government under far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is completely denying everything. Bolsonaro has refused and done everything he can to avoid locking down the economy because he argues that's really bad for the economy, you know, and everything has to stay open. And that influence of the president has had a really negative effect. I've recently moved from Rio de Janeiro in the south of Brazil, which is one of Bolsonaro's power bases, to Salvador in the northeast of Brazil. And in Rio de Janeiro, for instance, the police and the Guarda Municipal, which is like these municipal guards, they don't wear masks. Because a lot of them support Bolsonaro, and Bolsonaro for a long time didn't wear a mask, only occasionally wears a mask, called the pandemic just a little flu and said that it wasn't a big deal and everyone should stop crying, stop being pussies and stop being sissies. Now, I'm in Salvador, which is in the northeast of Brazil. It's in a state called Bahia, which is run by a governor from the Workers' Party, the left-wing party, and they've been a bit more serious about the pandemic, and the police do wear masks. It sort of feels to me like there are two societies in Brazil and they live in parallel universes. And there's the people who take the pandemic seriously. And these can be people on the right, people on the left, doctors, you know, businessmen, all kinds of people who take it seriously, who are very scared and would like to see a serious attempt to deal with it. And then there's people who support Bolsonaro, who live in this kind of weird parallel reality where everything's different, you know, and there's just fake news all the time. I think in the coming months, things are going to continue to be very dramatic in Brazil. The curve of deaths and cases is going to continue. I don't see Bolsonaro changing tack. He's got a new health minister, but he's going to continue pushing quack remedies. Bolsonaro has completely changed his stance from last year, saying he wouldn't get vaccinated and warning that if you took a vaccine, you might be turned into an alligator, or you know, if you're a woman, you might grow a beard, or if you're a man, you might develop a feminine voice. He's now decided that vaccination is a good idea. So he's completely flipped. And his supporters, who kind of consume a constant diet of fake news, which he feeds them, in this kind of George Orwell situation where, you know, the position can completely change from I'm against vaccine, no Chinese vaccine, you'll be turned into an alligator, to vaccine is the weapon of Brazil, let's all vaccinate. And they'll be all like, yeah, absolutely, without questioning it at all. So we're in that sort of numbers game, you know, it's going to continue being grim for quite a long time. Hopefully more dangerous and more aggressive variants like P1 don't emerge until then, because the other side of the tragedy of the COVID catastrophe in Brazil at the moment is that a lot of people in hospital are young with no health issues and the disease is much more aggressive.
Finally, those blue plaques, who gets them? Who should get them? And should there be more of them outside London? English Heritage, which runs the London scheme, has announced it's redressing gender imbalance somewhat with 6 new plaques commemorating notable women, including one for Princess Diana. Only 14% of the 950 existing plaques honour women. The other 5 of the new ones include the feminist social reformer Caroline Norton and Ellen Craft, a former American slave who escaped with her white husband to Britain and campaigned against slavery. She finally settled in Hammersmith, and her life looks like it should be a movie, frankly, never mind a plaque. Aisha, this is one of those few avenues where you can actually feel completely fine and good about national heritage, because everybody's kind of at the same level. They're stuck to a wall in the street. Everyone from any background is eligible, providing they are, I believe the phrase is, eminent within their own professional calling. They've lived in London and they've been dead for 20 years. But it is an awful lot of dead white men, isn't it?
Oh, totally. You know, and so I'm all for a bit of diversity with the blue plaques. I mean, of course, it's always like, you know, history is owned by white pompous men. And it would be good to change that. So I'm all for it. But, and I'm all for more interesting statues. But if we are going to have more diverse statues, please don't make them completely ridiculous, like poor Mary Wollstonecraft, or Silver Tits, as we call her, because she's just...
Oh my God, that's terrible, isn't it? It's just so awful.
But we did this on the bunker ages ago. I'm going to slightly bat for that, because it's not a statue of her.
Oh,
it's
don't get generalized... us that, Andrew. She's freezing her wee tits off there, and it's just cold.
Yeah, fair. It's a very desirable location, Newington Green, though. That is an odd and a weird one. But back to the plaques, Aisha. In 2016, only 4% of plaque recipients were Black or Asian, and English Heritage set up a working group for more Black and Asian nominees. And for the preceding 3 years, they'd received no nominations for Black or minority ethnic candidates at all.
Oh, that's terrible. I mean, that is terrible. That's just lazy as well. Like, I mean, this committee should be able to have the wherewithal to go and look for interesting people. I mean, here's one nomination. I would put a plaque up where a woman called Jayabene Desai, she is the woman that started the Grundwick strikes.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, was a really, really important ethnic minority figure. She galvanised the trade union movement, particularly at a time when the trade union movement didn't really care very much about ethnic minority workers. So there's one for them.
I mean, I think there's a funny thing going on here, which is that sometimes you just have to listen to the voices out there and they'll tell you who should be on the plaques. You know, it's not, oh, we haven't had enough applications. I mean, I'll give you an example. There's a guy called Patrick Vernon who did amazing work, a community activist who did amazing work around Windrush and was rightly honoured for the work he did around Windrush. He has been advocating for more plaques for great Black British people throughout history for decades. He's got a fantastic list. He's got people who should be on those plaques. He's been trying to put up his own version of plaques. There have been other people who, when they couldn't get the blue plaques put up, were trying to put up just their own version to commemorate the lives of Black British people around different parts of the country. Now, you just have to be in the space to hear those voices talking about that stuff to realize, okay, they've got some ideas about who should be on the plaques. Let's put them up. This idea that, oh, we just haven't had enough applications and we can't find it, now we have to do a big campaign to try and find out who these people would be, is a little bit distant from the actual people on the ground who could tell you if you asked them.
Do you think it might also be an honour that, you know, a large part of particularly Black and Afro-Caribbean culture was conditioned by the immigrations of the 50s, the Windrush generation, similarly Asian contributions to culture has been in many ways, a large part of it was to do with Afro-Asians coming in the 1970s, and that many of the significant people are still alive. Consequently, they don't qualify. That we may, as we start to look at this thing more closely, as time goes by and people qualify, shall we say, you may start to see more names from a broader spread.
Yeah, that would be fine, except that doesn't really stack up when you look at the few historic Black figures that we do know about, like Mary Seacole or whoever, and the resistance to putting up a statue of her, or to, you know, how long that took, or to be in a situation where just the ones that who we are aware of and we do know from the 18th century or the 19th century seem to be overlooked as well. So sure, you know, when we're all dead and gone, there'll be many more Black people on plaques somewhere. But in the meantime, at least honour the ones that we know about already from the last 200 years. And there's not much of an excuse for overlooking them.
Statues are of the hot button issue of now. But plaques aren't statues. They're much more kind of approachable. They put major figures into the environment and they humanise. It's like they lived in this house. I live in northeast London. I was walking around Clapton the other day. There's Harold Pinter just on the side of a regular terraced house. And I'm like, this is amazing. I suddenly felt myself transported into that. Should we think more about plaques and less about statues? Because the plaque puts the historical figure and you kind of toe to toe. Do you think, Matthew?
Well, first of all, I think there are lots of, I mean, forget Black Britons for a minute. You know, there are hundreds of people from the Indian subcontinent who have contributed massively to British history in the last couple of hundred years. You could spend years putting up plaques just for people.
That's very kind of you, but I've not been dead for 20 years.
but realistically, sure, we should think differently about plaques and statues. I think we need to lighten up about statues in this respect, that this idea that once a statue is up, it must never, ever come down, it must never, ever be moved, I think is a bizarre position that people take only because they want to object to a new statue going up. You know, the idea that we can, you know, people who deal with public spaces should be able to commemorate a variety of people in different ways, whether it's blue plaques or otherwise. They should be able to put up a statue in a new place. Maybe the one that's there at the moment should be moved somewhere else. It's not quite the right mood for that particular space anymore. We should be able to control and refresh our public spaces in the way that we want to. And if we had a little bit of if we lightened up a bit about how people control or use public space, I think we'd be much more relaxed about the kind of statues that are on there and the kind of things that are commemorated. And we'd be looking at ways that educated the public as they walk past and made them feel good about the space around them, as opposed to using the space as some kind of rigid historical record that must never, ever be changed.
Yeah. I hear, are you a plaque watcher?
Look, I'm a big fan of the blue plaque. I remember a couple of years ago, I was walking around West London and I saw, it just came up on Google Maps that Jawaharlal Nehru lived in a house that was around the corner. Yeah. And so I went to see Pandit Nehru's blue plaque, and I was there for quite a while before I realized that I was just staring at someone's house. And that did become uncomfortable after a point, and so I did leave. I do wonder how frequently that sort of thing happens to them, though.
Yeah,
I think that the night vision goggles probably didn't help.
Yeah, you shouldn't have hid in the hedge. It's got a sort of slightly stuck if you've got a plaque on your house.
It was the best vantage point.
the best plaque juxtaposition in London, I think it's Hornchurch Venison Yard, somewhere in Mayfair, but it's where George Frederick Handel and Jimi Hendrix are next door to each other, separated only by 200 years. But one does imagine a bit of kind of cultural interplay on the go there. Roz, I mean, so many of these plaques are concentrated in London. There's only a few outside the capital, but other cities do run their own schemes. London boroughs run their own schemes as well. There's an official John Lennon plaque in Liverpool. There's one in Oldham for the first fish and chip shop. Derby and Gateshead have schemes. Should we embrace this more nationally? Spread it all? Should English Heritage be running it for the whole country rather than making local authorities take responsibility for their own plaquing?
No, English Heritage should not. I mean, you know, it's incredibly expensive to get a blue plaque, and then it shoves the value of the house up quite a lot. So I think, to be honest, if you're going to be like her here and hang around outside the house, that's fine, because the advantage the owners are getting from having a blue plaque on their house is quite substantial. So you shouldn't feel guilty about it at all.
Roz, why is it expensive? Why is it expensive to get?
It's at least $2,000, according to the English Heritage. I looked it up, and to pay, I don't know why, but you have to have a proper blue one. It costs money, and it has to be all designed specially, and it's not free. But I like the kind of anarchic nature of some of the plaques, especially the ones you get outside London. But you do get some in London as well. I mean, there's the silly ones. There's one near me that says Charles Dickens stayed here in 1832, and it's like, come on, he probably stayed one night, and you're really trying to milk this, aren't you? But, equally, there's another one which is not a blue plaque because it's not where someone lived, which is being shoved in the most incongruous place. There's on the LSE campus, and it's below what used to be called Tower 1. There was Tower 1, Tower 2 and Tower 3. And I think that kind of sums up the vibe of this particular part of the LSE campus for you. And it's where the Pankhursts held their first meeting of the Women's Social and Political Union. And it's kind of in a bit of a yard where lorries park. It is because the original building has been completely demolished and it's just marking the site. So I really like that, because it's not about fetishizing some building. It's actually marking a place in an interesting way.
When I moved into my house in Brixton, shortly after I moved in, I got told by various people on my road that my house was the house where the biggest parties in the street were had, and the famous South London or London sound systems, reggae sound systems, Coxon Sound and Saxon Sound, would often play big parties at my house. And I thought that really needs some kind of commemorative plaque, because the whole of my road was completely rammed with people getting down to the best reggae in London all through the 70s and 80s. And I think that should just, that should be recognised somehow.
Right. You and I are taking this offline for the commemorative dub plate to be stuck on walls, because I'm in Stoke Newington, also the northern home of dub and reggae in London. So we're taking that one offline. We're going to do it, Matthew.
That. I'm with you. All right. For sure. Let's do it.
Back our Patreon. We come to the end of this week's Bunker, and as usual, we're going to ask the panel for their escape routes from politics. What are the TV, films, books, or miscellaneous that are taking their mind off the political world? Aisha, how about you? What are you escaping with this week?
I haven't had much time to escape because I've been like doing lots of extra shifts at Times Radio and getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and horrendous things like that. But I have tried to understand what's happening in Line of Duty, but it's like a glimpse into the future when I'm going to be senile and I'm just sat there watching it. And I'm like, I literally have no idea what is going on, but I'm pursuing that. And I have been watching The Flight Attendant as well, which is quite a quacky.
It's fantastic.
Thing. Yeah, it's good. I'm really enjoying it. It's really fun.
Mm. I hear. How about you?
It's MasterChef Finals week, Andrew. It's a huge goddamn deal. Obviously, that's me sorted for the rest of the week. Absolutely brilliant stuff.
Okay.
I want to say, as a vegetarian, I want to look at a bunch of things that I couldn't make and wouldn't eat. Like, and for some reason, that is unbearably thrilling to me.
I don't know what to say, Matthew. How about you? What's been your diversion?
Well, I'm going to try and be really optimistic and give like a recommendation for when we can leave our house and do stuff. Mm. So there's an exhibition that went on at the Tate by a brilliant artist from Streatham called Lynette Yodan-Boyecki, and it's called Fly in League with the Night. And it's an absolutely amazing exhibition. And it went on in November. And about 3 days after it went on, we went into lockdown again. And so it couldn't happen. But it's coming back on, I think, as soon as art galleries can open. And I'd really, really recommend it. It's absolutely amazing.
Fantastic. Ross, what about yours?
Well, I was listening to a podcast on BBC Sounds today, and it was by Laura Barton, who was an ex-colleague. She used to be on the Guardian, and now she's freelance. And it was all about being 17 in music and songs that reference being 17. And it's amazing. It's really beautiful. Laura has the most amazing voice. It's just incredibly soothing and lovely. And she's done such an evocative piece of work. In terms of TV, yeah, I watch some really crap TV. There's a series on All Four, which is called Soupçon in the original French, but they've translated it mysteriously as Torn. And it's basically set in the south of France in the Luberon, and it's a load of French people just, you know, being unfaithful to each other and generally getting themselves in trouble, and there are murders, and it's entirely, the plot twist is entirely predictable. It's great. It's fantastic. I totally recommend it. Complete escapism.
High quality telly. This is what we like. Well, mine, I mean, isn't, I'm breaking the rules again, because it's not really an escape from politics. It's another fantastic podcast called How They Made Us Doubt Everything, which is a BBC Sounds job. It's Peter Pomerantsov, who we've had as a guest on the Bunker, and it goes through the playbook of how big tobacco in the 1950s undermined research that proved that smoking caused cancer, how that playbook was then taken on by oil and by numerous other people, you know, climate change denial and so forth. Essentially, this is how you stop people from accepting evidence. This is how you introduce doubt. This is how you create false debates. This is how you turn 97% certainty into a 50-50 debate where Nigel Lawson's beliefs are as important as an accredited climate scientist. It's a fantastic listen. And the episode's only 13 minutes long. We could probably learn a bit from that on The Bunker. Brief and to the point. Really good. So when you've listened to The Bunker, have a listen to how They Made Us Doubt Everything on BBC Sounds. It's very good. And that is the end of this week's podcast. Thanks to Aisha Hazarika.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Ahir Shah.
Thank you.
Thanks to Roz Taylor.
Thank you.
And thanks to our special guest, Matthew Ryder QC, who's now going to be collecting dub plates with me to nail to walls.
Looking forward to it.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily and the full-length show this time next week. Do follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favourite app. And if you enjoyed the show, you can back us on Patreon. Just say our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. Backers to the podcast get an honorary salute on the show, and here are some now.
Thanks from me to Kieran Sunstrom, Sinead Walsh, and Claudio Capozzi.
Hello, and best wishes from me to David P., Dean, Susan, and Pease, and Dara McGuire.
Hi, McGuire. And thanks from me to Cheney King, David Derbyshire, and John Irving.
And hello, and best wishes from me to Justin O'Hanlon, Anne Byrne, and Rodri Lewis. We'll see you next week.
The Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison, with Ahir Shah, Aisha Hazarika, and Ros Taylor. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yolna Sofronievich. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.